Okay, so what I thought we'd do today, because we've only got kind of 40, 45 minutes, is to look at some critics, because we haven't done that at all yet, and we can do that reasonably quickly. Just some notes about critics, some brief introduction notes about critics. There are enough things written about King Lear to fill several libraries, and you can get utterly lost in kind of critical notes about King Lear. If you type in King Lear critics or King Lear on the internet, you will get millions and millions of hits, from blogs to posts to academic articles. The whole point of critics, as you know, is to illuminate your understanding of the text, and to give you another way of looking at the text, either to reinforce and to back up what you think about the text and what you're saying about text, or to look at it from an alternative point of view. And one of the really important things in your essay is that you show, not all the way through, but you show at points, you understand that there are different ways of viewing the text. So while some people might say Cordelia is, I was just talking to Lauren about Cordelia is truthful and honest and good in the opening of the play, other people might say actually she's disloyal to her father, disobedient to her father, and she breaks the conventions of father-daughter relationships. So there are two very different ways of looking at that character. And what a critic does is simply give you another point of view of the text, and it gives you a kind of way into looking at different views of the text. The reason I bought this edition of King Lear that you've all got is because it's got some excellent notes at the back of it, both for critics and for context. So don't forget, when you're doing your revision, obviously you're going through the notes that you've made with me and looking at the text and doing all those sorts of things, but there's some really useful notes in the back of this. Some notes on... where are we? Some notes on the text, on the critics, on the context, on different themes, all at the back. I think there's something at the start. Oh, and there's an introduction at the front, commentary. Quote, a critics.
Yeah.
I would suggest that you have maybe 4 or 5 critical quotes up your sleeve. Short quotes. Same as remembering the text, short quotes. But try and pick quotes, and we'll do a bit of this now. Try and pick quotes that you're going to be able to use in a number of different places. The danger with learning quotes, whether it's a critic quote or a quote from the text, is that you get into the exam and you think, I've learned this, I'm going to use it, whatever happens. I remember doing exactly that in one of my A-level exams, thinking I've learned this quote, so whether it's relevant or not, I'm going to get it in because it took me hours to learn. But we don't want to do that. You want to use quotes that you can legitimately use in a number of different contexts. So the, on page 143, 143 in your King Lear books, there are 4 pages of critics. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different critics quoted. And they covered... they are the biggest names in Shakespearean criticism. And they also cover different time periods of criticism. So Samuel Johnson, obviously a very different time period to someone like A.C. Bradley, who's one of the last ones.
Sorry.
That's right. So what I'm going to suggest we do is to look through these and just pick out the lines, the quotes, the ideas that we could use, and talk about where we could use them and why. I don't know, do you want me to read them to you, or do you want to read them yourself? What did you say? Read them yourselves?
Yeah.
Is that right, or do you want me to read them? I'm happy either way.
I do mine.
Okay. Alright. I tell you what, we'll do a bit of both. I'll read the first one, and then you can read it. So, Samuel Johnson on page 143. So Samuel Johnson said, "The tragedy of Lear is deservedly celebrated among the dramas of Shakespeare. There is perhaps no play which keeps the attention so strongly fixed. which so much agitates our passions and interests our curiosity. The artful involutions of distinct interests, the striking opposition of contrary characters, the sudden changes of fortune, and the quick succession of events fill the mind with a perpetual tumult of indignation, pity, and hope. There is no scene which does not contribute to the aggravation of the distress or conduct of action, and scarce a line which does not conduce to the progress of the scene. So powerful is the current of the poet's imagination that the mind which once ventures within it is hurried irresistibly along. But Shakespeare has suffered the virtue of Cordelia to perish in a just cause, contrary to the natural ideas of justice, to the hope of the reader, and, what is yet more strange, to the fate of chronicles. A play in which the wicked prosper and the virtuous miscarry may doubtless be good, because it is a just representation of the common events of human life. But since all reasonable beings naturally love justice, I cannot easily be persuaded that the observation of justice makes a play worse, or that, if other excellences are equal, the audience will not always rise better pleased from the final triumph of persecuted virtue. In the present case, the public has decided. Cordelia, from the time of Tate, has always retired with victory and felicity. And if my sensations could add anything to the general suffrage, I might relate that I was many years ago so shocked by Cordelia's death that I know not whether I ever endured to read again the last scenes of the play till I undertook to revise them as an editor. So that's from his essays, The Plays of William Shakespeare, written in 1765. So just clock the date, 1765, about 160 odd years after Shakespeare wrote the play and it was first performed. But still a long way from where we are today. Alright, so if you want a minute, because there's a lot to take in there, just have a quick scan back through and try and pick out that they're your copies of the play. You won't need to take them into the text, so you can annotate them if you want, or make notes, whatever's easiest. Just have a think about what you can learn from there, what's of interest there, and what can we use in our thinking and in our essays. Yeah, that's it. So have a think. For the recording, there will now be a 3-minute interval.
So I don't know if someone makes a good critic.
What What you're looking for is a quote that seems to say something about a theme in the play or an idea in the play that you might well end up writing about. So justice, the God, all the ones that we've been through. It's a good critic for something like this is a really strong statement or a strong judgment or belief about the play that you can use either to agree with what you're saying or to challenge what you're saying and look at it from a different perspective. Okay, well, I know you're kind of going through it. We'll carry on going through it together. Okay, so what do you pick? Go on, Sam, what have you got?
It's hard to understand because of the language, so I can't really back up
okay.
my ideas because...
Yeah. I mean, it is hard because it's written in 1760-something, so... Yeah, so the language is difficult. Lauren?
It says, all reasonable beings naturally love justice.
Right. Good. Since all reasonable beings naturally love justice, why have you picked that and why is it relevant?
Because justice doesn't always prevail in King Lear.
Right.
So I think that it's kind of, if you know the end of the page, I feel like a bit... ambiguous about it because you're like,
what
was all the justice
men? Good.
Why are all the good
characters? Yeah. Like, absolutely. No, that's right, because he goes on to say, since all reasonable beings naturally love justice, I cannot easily be persuaded that the observation of justice makes a play worse. Or that if other excellences are equal, the audience will not always rise better pleased than the final triumph of persecuted virtue. What he's actually doing here is criticising Shakespeare. Horror, shock. Criticising Shakespeare for the ending of the play. And he says in his first paragraph, two paragraphs, that he praises the play, and we'll look at that in a minute, but he goes on to say that the big flaw with this play, the problem with this play, is that justice isn't observed. He does say, and we'll look at it in a minute, he does say, of course, that kind of reflects life. Life isn't always just. But he says, seeing as all reasonable beings naturally love justice, why would you, if you have the opportunity to create a story in a play, why wouldn't you create a play in which justice is observed at the end? So we can use that quote, any of that really. So if I was learning that kind of bit around there, I would perhaps learn the phrase, reasonable beings naturally love justice. 5 words. Okay.
So what if we don't remember the critic's name?
No, it doesn't matter if you don't remember his name. It's better if you do. Samuel Johnson is... Remember Samuel Johnson said... I've forgotten it myself. Said, reasonable beings naturally love justice. Then it's better, but you don't have to. And if you're in an exam and you think, I can't remember what his name, can't remember, don't not use the quote, use the quote. All of the critics in here are quite famous, so you could even say, as the famous Shakespearean critic put it, I kind of leave it a bit vague as to who that famous critic is. Use it if you remember, if you can, that would be better. Good, right, Alex, what do you pick?
Minus justice, but when it says,
good.
That basically the play shows justice in the way you wouldn't expect it to because it's not actually achieved.
Good, absolutely. You know, one of the questions of the play, and we'll look at justice in tomorrow maybe, but one of the questions of the play is it just? And you can argue it from different ways. It feels unjust, doesn't it? You get to the end, the characters are lying dead on the stage, it feels unjust. But you can actually argue from every character that their end is just. Cordelia is disobedient. She goes against the great chain of being, the natural order of things, and disobeying her father. She's belligerent. So she gets her just deserves at the end, you could say. It doesn't feel like that, does it? But you could argue it. But the question has raged, and we talked about this some time ago when we were talking about it. We talked about a Christian reading of the play, and a Christian critical reading of the play has argued that Shakespeare is suggesting, yes, justice is in place. That this is a play that maintains God's justice, or rather, that kind of celebrates God's justice in a way. But what Johnson says, without any doubt or shadow of doubt, is that this is a play in which justice is not served. And that phrase, which is a famous quote about the play, contrary to the natural ideas of justice.
If you just like remember one part of the name, could you just put like Johnson?
Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't remember Samuel, remember Johnson. Yeah. And that would be fine to do, just remember him as Johnson. He's a big enough name in literary criticism to know immediately who he is. There, perhaps you might want to learn natural ideas of justice, or contrary to the natural ideas of justice. The quote is a brilliant one. He suggests that Cordelia dying at the end is contrary, that is against, the natural ideas of justice, to the hope of the reader, and what is yet more strange, to the faith of Chronicles. The faith of Chronicles alludes to the fact that Shakespeare changed the story of King Lear, because of course King Lear is a story that had been told many times before. It was a mythical story. But in most of the previous incarnations of the story, Cordelia lives at the end. Shakespeare made the decision. He didn't just inherit the story and have to kill at the end because it was a story he inherited. He decided, he made that decision to kill Cordelia at the end. And that Johnson can't understand it. Johnson is a very renowned writer himself, one of the towering figures of English literature. But he looks at what Shakespeare did and says, I just can't understand why he would write a play that goes against the natural ideas of justice. The audience leaves unhappy. He doesn't even have to do it because it's not in the history of the story. Why would he have killed Cordelia at the end? Allowed Cordelia to perish. And it's a really useful quote for exploring that thing. You can write your way around that quote. And it's good, Sarah, to answer your question, what makes a good quote? It's good because it says something really kind of clear and striking about it. He said, for sure, this is what I think about it. And you either agree or you disagree with him. Or...
You wouldn't have to say in the thing that you agree with.
Oh, no. You could use it in a number of ways. You could use it as a link. So if you're, you know, your point, evidence, explain, you're talking about justice, Cordelia at the end, perhaps you might want to say the fact is, or the idea as to whether what happens to Cordelia is just or not has been one that critics have argued about since the play was first performed. For example, Johnson has stated that. Put that in. And you can respond to that, or you can simply leave it as an open question. That's fine.
Can you use it in the explanation
as well? Yeah. And you can use it to introduce, you know, you could use it as a way into it as well. Just as an aside, nothing to do with critics, really, although kind of. It is fine in your essay to not say what you think about everything. It's fine in your essay to say what I think is there are no easy answers here, and I'm not sure. You know, in terms of is the play a just one, yes and no, it is. But the whole point of King Lear is that there are no easy answers. That's what Shakespeare was doing for being King Lear. He was showing us that life isn't wrapped up in easy answers. You can't listen to what the church tells you necessarily. Established, received wisdom might not necessarily be right. But neither should you listen to everything that anybody else says. This is a play in which you end up and go, I don't know. Is it just? Is it not? Are the gods in control? Are they not? Was Edmund right? Was he wrong? Should Cordelia play the game at the beginning, or shouldn't she? Is it right to be Machiavellian or not? Well, at the end of the play, I'm not sure we know the answers to those questions. But that's the point for me. And it's fine to say that that's the point. Ambiguity and confusion and complexity is the point of this play, not easy answers. I said that once. I'll never forget it. In a similar setting, it was about 6 years ago, I was teaching a class, King Lear, but not long after I'd started teaching in the school. And one of the students just put her pen down and said, "That's typical, that is. It's always the same in English, never an answer." And she just sat there with her arms folded for the rest of the time. Could she hide? Sorry. I obviously offended her greatly. We laughed about it afterwards. Right. Okay, what else? And what else did we pick out from here? Kiwi, did you pick anything out?
I don't know if it's relevant.
Go on.
The sudden changes of fortune and the quick succession of events.
Yeah.
Filling the mind with a perpetual love of indignation, but you know.
Yeah, good. Absolutely right.
Say a bit of it, didn't he?
The sudden change of fortune, the quick succession of events, fill the mind with a perpetual tumult of indignation, pity, and hope. In other words, this is a play in which so much happens so quickly. It's talking about the intensity of the play, the change of fortune, the succession of events, and there's bits before that, the distinct interest, the striking opposition of contrary characters. In other words, we've got these characters who are so different, Edmund and Edgar, Cordelia and Goneril. These characters who are so opposed, different to each other. It's a play of extremes, he's suggesting. It's a play of huge intensity. And probably the most useful bit in terms of criticism there is the end of that, where he says, it fills the mind with a perpetual tumult of indignation, pity and hope. It kind of links to what I've just said, which is that this play never allows the audience to sit easily. This is a play in which Shakespeare keeps us as an audience always in a sense of discomfort. What should I think now? What should I believe now? You know, some of the things we've talked about at the end when France is attacking England with Cordelia as the head of that army. Well, who do we support? Cordelia is our character. She's the angelic daughter come back to save her father, but she's at the head of a French army. So of course we didn't support her because she's French and they're the old enemy. So as an audience, particularly as a Renaissance audience, our minds are filled with indignation, pity and hope. It's a play that won't allow us to rest easy. An uncomfortable watch. It is an uncomfortable watch, isn't it? When we went to see it at the cinema, it was a brilliant production. I loved it, but it was uncomfortable to see somebody fall apart before you on the screen. Okay, good. Any more picked out there? I mean, that's plenty, and there are more there. Just to remind you, do you remember Nahum Tate? He's referred to here. He says it's where is it? The last paragraph on the first page. In the present case, the public has decided. Cordelia, from the time of Tate, has always retired with victory and felicity. We have talked about Nahum Tate, but it was a while ago. Remember what Nahum Tate did?
He take Shakespeare and put it back on stage.
Yeah, he rewrote it. He rewrote the ending. Jonson also rewrote the end of Shakespeare, of King Lear, as he alludes to at the end there. But Nahum Tate rewrote the end, and it was Nahum Tate's version of King Lear that was performed for nearly 300 years in the theatre. 250 years. Jonson says the public has decided. The public does not want to watch a play that ends like Shakespeare has it end. They want to watch a play that finishes with Cordelia marrying Edgar, saving the old king and everybody being happily ever after. That's what happens in Nahum Tate's version. Cordelia is saved, she marries Edgar. Poor Tom is rescued, and Cordelia and Edgar go on and rule the kingdom. It's what would in future years be known as the Hollywood ending.
You know the one we read? Is it Fully Shakespeare?
Fully Shakespeare, yeah. But with any Shakespeare text, there's always some controversy about which parts are actually Shakespeare and which parts have been added since. But this is as close to the original Shakespeare text as you can get. When a Shakespeare play was put on, it was often rewritten in performance. So Shakespeare would write it, work with a group of actors, the Chamberlain men, and you know, bits would be rewritten. They'd perform a scene, oh, it doesn't work, we'll rewrite that. And so there have been lots and lots of different versions of the play floating around the theatres, of the first draft, the second draft, the third draft. And then sometimes plays would be, other playwrights, other groups would put the play on and they'd rewrite a bit of it as well, and it would have nothing to do with Shakespeare at all. So we're never completely sure that the version we have is entirely Shakespeare or his kind of final draft of it, but it's as close as we can get, given the years between then and now. The printing press and the when they collected all his work and put it into what's called the first quarter, that's as good as we get. Right, let's have a look at Charles Lamb then. In 1812. Yeah, of course. So this is what Charles Lamb said of King Lear. So to see Lear acted, to see an old man tottering about the stage with a walking stick, turned out of doors by his daughters in a rainy night, has nothing in it but what is painful and disgusting. We want to take him into shelter and relieve him. That is all the feeling which the acting of Lear ever produced in me. But the Lear of Shakespeare cannot be acted. The contemptible machinery by which they mimic the storm which he goes out in is not more adequate to represent the horrors of the real elements than any actor can be to represent Lear. The greatness of Lear is not in corporal dimension, but in intellectual. The explosions of his passion are terrible as a volcano. They are storms turning up and disclosing to the bottom of that sea his mind with all its vast riches. It is his mind which is laid bare. This case of flesh and blood seems too insignificant to be thought on, even as he himself neglects it. On the stage, we see nothing but corporal infirmities and weakness, the impotence of rage. While we read it, we see not Lear, but we are Lear. We are in his mind. We are sustained by a grandeur which baffles the malice of daughters and storms. In the aberrations of his reason, we discover a mightily irregular power of reasoning, immethodized from the ordinary purposes of life, but exerting its powers as the wind bloweth where it listeth, at will upon the corruptions and abuses of mankind. Okay, so the language is still tricky there. I'll paraphrase them for you. What he basically says is King Lear is dreadful on the stage. It's not a play to be watched, he says. I would disagree profoundly, but that's what Charles Lamb, maybe he saw a bad version of it. But he says it's impossible. But he's not criticising Shakespeare as such. In a sense, what he's saying is he said Shakespeare has written a terrible play, but a brilliant piece of literature, is what he says. You can't see it, but you can read it. Because he says, when you read it, you are Lear. You don't see Lear, but you become Lear in your reading of it. And you kind of live with Lear through that, through the grandeur and the descent into madness. The image he uses, he says, it's as impossible for an actor to properly capture this character Lear as it is for a stage to make it look like a storm was really happening. Given that he's writing in 1812, the only way they had of making a storm happening was some people backstage banging a drum and making it sound a bit rainy. That was kind of as good as they got. So he said it's as impossible for a theatre or a stage to produce a storm, a real storm, as it is for an actor to properly play Lear. He says it's too big, the character's too big, it's too grand, it's too significant a character to play. And any quotes that stuck out there that you could learn and use? Go on.
The greatness of Lear is not in corporal dimension, but intellectual.
Brilliant. The greatness of Lear is not in corporal dimensions, about halfway down that passage, but in intellectual. And any of that bit, actually, the explosions of his passion are terrible as a volcano.
There are storms turning up and disclosing to the bottom that sea his mind with all its vast riches. What could you use that for? What kind of, what might you be discussing at the time to use a quote like that?
I would say that when he says all is true, is true is when he's mad.
Yes.
It's all in his mind. Yeah. He might not get mad on the other, but instead he's speaking.
Yeah. Good. Really good. The greatness of Lear is not in his corporal dimension, but in his intellectual. This idea of a mind driven mad into madness, but at the same time capturing some enormous truths about life. Now what Lamb suggests towards the end of there, he says, we are in his mind, we are sustained by a grandeur which baffles the malice of daughters and storms. He suggests that in King Lear, actually, the greatness of Lear, the greatness of Lear's mind and what happens to Lear is much greater than the malice of daughters and storms. Malice, evil of daughters and storms. So for Lamb, when you get to the end of the play, actually, unlike Johnson, you're not, when you read it at least, not when you see it on the stage, but when you read it, what you're left with is not the injustice of it all and the hopelessness of it all, but actually what you're left with is the power of the human mind. You're left with the grandeur of Lear's mind. So if you're discussing ideas about the play suggesting that life is meaningless, hopeless, that the gods are silent, that there's no justice, actually what Lamb believes the play is really about is about the grandeur of the human mind. It's a very humanist reading of the play in some ways. Okay, let's move on to Hazlitt. Also 1817, 5 years later than Charles Lamb. Something significant happened in 1815. What happened in 1815? Battle of Waterloo, in 1815? Historians among me. My degree was half history. I should know that, shouldn't I? Yeah, I found that, probably I've said this before, I found a folder up in the loft, in my handwriting, so I must have written it, of essays that I wrote under exam conditions for my history degree. And not only did I not remember writing the essays, I can't even remember knowing what I knew to write those essays. Do you know what I mean? I found one about Renaissance, medieval and Renaissance art in cathedrals around Europe. And I'd written it in an exam, so I'd known it really well. But if you'd asked me 5 minutes before, have you ever studied medieval and Renaissance art? I'd say, no, never. And there it was, frightening what the mind will do. Talking about the grandeur of the human mind. Not much grandeur there. Right, let's have a look at William Hazlitt. We wish that we could pass this play over and say nothing about it. All that we can say must fall far short of the subject, or even of what we ourselves conceive of it. To attempt to give a description of the play itself or of its effects upon the mind is mere impertinence. The mind of Lear, staggering between the weight of attachment and the hurried movements of passion, is like a tall ship driven about by the winds, buffeted by the furious waves, but that still rides above the storm, having its anchor fixed in the bottom of the sea. Or it's like the sharp rock circled by the eddying whirlpool that foams and beats against it. Or like the solid promontory pushed from its basis by the force of an earthquake. Okay. What are we talking about here? What's he discussing? Madness.
Yeah.
Madness. The mind of Lear. What he says about him is quite interesting. He says it's a great place. I love it when he says it's one that we wish we could pass over. That's quite a nice quote to use. We wish that we could pass this play over. We wish that we could ignore it.
If it didn't have Shakespeare's name to it, it would be easier to do that. We wish we could ignore it. Why do people wish they could ignore it? Because it's a bad play? Because the ending's not, it's a difficult play. The ending's not what you want. It's a play that asks too many questions and gives us too few answers. Like that student 5 years ago who wished she could pass the play over and not deal with more questions she couldn't answer. And that talks a lot about the play's effect on an audience. But he goes on to say that the mind of Lear is staggering between the weight of attachment and the hurried movements of passion. So even if you just remembered staggering as a quote, that would work. Hazlitt describes Lear's mind as staggering into madness. And then he uses these images, and all of the images suggest the same thing, that his mind is put through or forced to become chaotic. And put through the worst of times, the worst of storms, but in it all, it stays solid. He says, it's like a tall ship, but there still rides above the storm, having its anchor fixed. Or it's like a sharp rock circled by the sea beating and foaming against it. Or like a cliff. That's moved in an earthquake but still stands. You've seen those kind of cliffs that are pushed out to sea, so you're left literally with a cliff edge and then a big gap before you get back to land, that promontory. So what he's saying is, despite the madness of Lear, it still stays rooted to something, it stays fixed and firm to something. So you can discuss that with you talking about madness and sanity and finding wisdom in the middle of madness. You can also use that, any of those quotes, when you're talking about justice and the sense of what where do we get to at the end of the play. Well, yeah, it's been horrific to sit through, but we get to the end of it, and Hazlitt suggests that Lear's mind is still fixed firm by the end. There is a sense of justice here. He's restored at the end to some kind of order. Okay, it's time. We've got three critics left. We'll do one more, because he's weenie, and then we'll do the last two, Moulton and Bradley, next time. Okay, so John Keats, 1817. Same year as Hazlitt. Anyone read any Keats? Sorry. Heard of him, yeah. Keats, we haven't done any Keats, have we, now? Oh well, can't do everything. Poet, John Keats. Again, one of the towering figures of English literature. He said this about Lear: the excellence of every art is its intensity, capable of making all disagreeables evaporate from their being in close relationship with beauty and truth. Examine King Lear. You will find this exemplified throughout. It's a really, really bold statement that he makes. He says, and the quotes that you want to learn here, he says, disagreeables evaporate. Disagreeables are things we don't like. Disagreeables evaporate because they're in close relationship with beauty and truth. So Keats suggests that beauty and truth in King Lear are more powerful than the disagreeables. Go on. I don't know if I agree. I don't think I do agree. But I kind of see what he's saying. Yeah, not even more important, but the more powerful. That when we really look at it, he challenges, go on, look at it. Really look at King Lear. Examine King Lear, he says. You will find this exemplified throughout. You'll see that because beauty and truth are in close proximity, they're in close relationship with disagreeables, then the disagreeables evaporate. So you've got to think about what is that beauty and truth. Well, perhaps it's the wisdom that Lear finds in the middle of his madness. Maybe it's the fool's words of wisdom. Maybe it's the beauty of Cordelia's honesty and her attempt to come back and rescue her father at the end. Perhaps it's Edgar's loyalty to his father. Perhaps it's Cordelia's forgiveness of Lear and Lear's repentance at the end when he kneels down in front of Cordelia. All of those things, Keats suggests, are beauty and truth, and they're more important, they're more significant than all of the disagreeables, the lying and the untruths and the evil that we see in the play. It'd be a brilliant quote for the essay that we were looking at yesterday, when we looked at truth. Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. I will put that recording on the website.